Herzlich willkommen zu unserem Podcast in der Reihe Zeitbühne. Mein Name ist Roman Blätter, ich bin stellvertretender Leiter des Wirtschaftsressorts der Zeit und moderiere diesen Podcast, in dem wir Gespräche von Zeitredakteurinnen und Redakteuren mit Gästen aus Politik, Wirtschaft und Kultur präsentieren. Heute hören wir ein Gespräch mit dem amerikanischen Schriftsteller Jonathan Safran Foer vom 23. Januar auf der Bühne im Kaufleuten in Zürich. Darin ging es um Foers neues Buch »Wir sind das Klima«, in dem er sich mit der Frage auseinandersetzt, wie und warum der Einzelne etwas tun kann und sollte, um gegen den Klimawandel zu kämpfen. Bevor wir uns das Gespräch gleich anhören, habe ich jetzt erst einmal meine Zeit-Online-Kollegin Judith Luig am Telefon, damit sie uns Jonathan Safran Foer kurz vorstellt. Sie hat nämlich auch das Gespräch mit ihm in Zürich geführt. Hallo Judith.
Hallo Roman.
Judith, du bist nicht nur Politikredakteurin, sondern auch Literaturwissenschaftlerin. Kanntest du Foers Werk vorher schon oder hast du dich neu eingelesen?
Ja, absolut. Also sein erster Roman ist ja 2002 erschienen, Alles ist erleuchtet auf Deutsch, und das war damals schon eine große Sensation. Er war so ein Novelist-Wunderkind, hat sehr, sehr jung diesen Roman geschrieben, mit Anfang 20, und das Paar Jonathan Safran Foer und seine damalige Frau Nicole Krauss waren auch befreundet mit Paul Auster und Siri Hustvedt. Es waren so sozusagen literarische Adoptiveltern, und diese vier haben damals literarische Szene ziemlich durcheinander gewirbelt, und alle waren irgendwie interessiert an ihnen. Es hatte so ein bisschen Glamour in der Literaturszene auf einmal.
Und was hat dich nun an dem aktuellen Buch besonders beeindruckt?
Naja, als ich gefragt wurde, ob ich die Moderation machen möchte, war ich zuerst total begeistert, weil ich dachte, wow, er hat einen neuen Roman geschrieben. Das wäre dann sein vierter gewesen. Die anderen drei sind alle Bestseller geworden. Ich habe sie unheimlich gern gelesen, dachte, toll, ich kann mit ihm über Literatur sprechen. Und dann habe ich auf einmal in der Bahnhofsbuchhandlung das Buch gesehen, Wir sind das Klima, und dachte, oh Gott, er hat schon wieder ein Buch geschrieben, dass ich keine Tiere essen soll, Mist. Aber da hat die schon zugesagt.
Kanntest du denn das Buch über die Tiere auch schon?
Das kannte ich eigentlich nicht vom eigenen Lesen, sondern dadurch, dass mein Freund das gelesen hat, dass es vor 10 Jahren erschienen ist. Tiere essen heißt das ja, und eigentlich ist die Idee, dass man keine Tiere mehr essen soll. Und mein Freund hat das damals dann ziemlich konsequent umgesetzt. Das heißt, wir konnten nicht mehr zum Österreicher gehen, wir konnten nur noch Pilzrisotto zu Hause essen und so. Also es war eine ziemliche Veränderung in meinem Leben. Ich habe es also selber gar nicht gelesen, und trotzdem hat es mein ganzes Leben auf den Kopf gestellt.
Ihr habt ja in Zürich dann abends mit Foer auch noch gegessen. Was habt ihr denn dann gegessen?
Das war relativ schwierig, weil wir natürlich vor der Veranstaltung die Speisekarten hinten in die Garderobe gereicht bekommen haben. Und im Kaufleuten in Zürich, da kann man herrliches Schnitzel essen, und es ist ganz berühmt für seine großartigen Fischspezialitäten und so. Und alle blätterten so etwas betreten durch die Menükarten und sagten so, was isst du denn? So auf Deutsch dann schnell. Und Föhr hat das sofort gemerkt und meinte, ja, ihr könnt gerne essen, was ihr wollt. Also ich kenne das schon, das Problem. Aber man traute sich tatsächlich nicht wirklich, das Fleisch zu bestellen in seiner Gegenwart.
Liebe Judith, das prägt auch schon den Geist dieses Gesprächs wieder, das ja dann tatsächlich ein Gespräch war, in dem er sehr mild umgeht mit Menschen, die einen vielleicht nicht ganz so radikalen Lebenswandel suchen, wie er es tut. Ich danke dir für deine Zeit, und Ihnen, liebe Zuhörer, wünsche ich nun viel Freude mit Jonathan Safran Foer im Gespräch mit meiner Kollegin Judith Luig über die Frage, wie sich das Klima retten lässt, darüber, warum Donald Trump dabei sogar helfen könnte, und über Besucher einer Lesung, die Foers Leben verändert haben, weil er sich an ihnen als Klimaschützern ein Beispiel genommen hat. Aber hören Sie selbst.
I don't care. What order? Thank you, Matthias. Good evening, everyone. It's a great pleasure to welcome you all to this great location tonight. I was so pleased when I heard that we will have our reading at this wonderful venue, because the Kaufleuten, I don't know if you know this, was the place where Prince used to perform on stage when he went to play in Zurich. This was where you, well, this is where you discover new exciting bands. So I think it's a very appropriate place for the two of us tonight. And all of us. So our subject, though, is artistic only on the one hand. It's also a very bitter reality. We want to discuss a beautifully written book about a very stressful topic, if I might say so. The climate is in crisis and so are we. To stop global warming, there have been many approaches, many proposals. Most of them are really radical. Green politicians want us to stop or to ban fossil fuels. Antinatalists want us to stop having children. Environmentalists want to have really high taxes on plane tickets or want to ban or stop cruise ship. So there's a lot of ideas and most of them are, let's say, a little more difficult. And Jonathan Serfenfer now is offering a more, let's say, sympathetic and maybe a more doable approach to stop the climate change. And it's basically that we should consider to stop eating animals or animal products before the sunset. I thought this was also a bit romantic to say, so daytime veganism, is this really such an easy solution as it sounds? And this is what we want to discuss today with our author. Welcome, Jonathan Serfenfer.
Thank you very much. Thank
you. We're very glad to have you. Congratulations to this wonderfully compelling book, Jonathan. This is your fifth international bestseller in a row, and you only wrote 5 books. So it's quite amazing, I think. Though I must admit that when I first heard the topic, I thought, okay, again, did you not ruin meat for me 10 years ago already? I mean, do you really have to embark on the topic again? What brought you back to the topic of vegetarianism or veganism?
Well, first of all, thank you for coming. It's a pleasure to be here, and it's so nice that there's a room full of people who are eager to talk about a subject that is sometimes very interesting and sometimes can make one feel hopeful and resolved, but is often very scary and difficult to talk about. So I'm always... I know that I sometimes avoid the conversation very often in life, and I'm glad that you chose not to avoid the conversation tonight. When you were speaking the introduction, I could have sworn you said global warning and not global warming. Did anybody else hear that? Yeah. So my therapist in New York would have very often says to me, did you hear what you just said? Did you hear what you just said? And I think that my book is very much about that, the kind of difference between what our subconscious is telling us and what our conscious minds are telling us about global warming. Because I, for one, I began to notice that I had two different lives. One life was the person who read the science and, of course, acknowledged the science and shared interesting statistics at dinner parties and would go to marches and have, you know, create interesting, witty posters and would watch videos of Greta Thunberg and get very emotional and watch news reports of Trump and get very angry. And there was no question that I was one of the good people. And then I had another life, which was the life that I actually lived, rather than the life that was in my mind or the life that I spoke. And in the life that I lived, I was doing all of the things that in the life that I spoke, I knew were wrong. And I don't mean wrong by somebody else's definition. I just mean wrong by my own definition. And every now and then I would have these kind of confrontations with that other self, like when you said global warning instead of warming, I would hear myself, you know? I would hear myself saying things that I wasn't doing. And I began to notice that I was sort of alienated from myself. I think that among the many things that climate change makes us feel, like alarm, like fear, like sadness, is also an alienation from ourselves, like a recognition that we're living through a moment that depends on us and we're not rising to the occasion. So I had no interest in writing a book about meat. at all. I liked that I wrote the book before, Eating Animals, and I was proud of it, and I said everything that I wanted to say on the subject. And after having written the book, I didn't feel alienated anymore. I actually felt very comfortable that I knew who I wanted to be with relation to that problem, and it is an enormous problem. Even if I couldn't always be that person perfectly, which I write about in the book, I was at least on a path toward the person I wanted to be. But when it came to climate change, there was just too much of a distance, and it became intolerable. So that was what I wanted to write about. The problem for you and the problem for me is that you cannot write about climate change honestly without talking about meat. It is too big a part of the puzzle. In their most recent report, the IPCC, which is now like the gold standard for climate science, said that even if we were to do everything else that we're talking about, you know, with regard to fossil fuels, if you can imagine this theater never turning the lights on again, and Zurich never turning the lights on again, and planet Earth never turning the lights on again, and nobody in this room or in Zurich or on planet Earth ever driving again or ever flying again, we still cannot meet the goals of the Paris Climate Accords unless we change how we eat. And so in order to write an honest book about closing up this distance between my two selves, I had to return to the subject.
And this is why you come to the subject so late in your book, because it's like on page 63 in the American edition, I think in the German it's even later, in 78 or something. Ah, okay, I see now. So the subject was brought back to you somehow when you started the writing, yeah?
Well, no, I knew from page one.
Okay.
But, you know, the reason I didn't talk about it for so long is because, well, there's two reasons. One, I know that it makes people defensive. Mm-hmm. It's the same reason that Al Gore never talks about the fact that he's vegan. It's the same reason that Greta Thunberg very, very rarely talks about the fact that she's vegan, for both of them for environmental reasons. Meat makes us, you know, sensitive, and it makes people defensive and aggressive. And I would say for very good reason, mm-hmm. which is that we care. You know, when somebody at a reading, it happens every now and then. Am I speaking? Can everybody hear me?
Yeah.
Okay. When if at a reading, sometimes it's very rare, but sometimes somebody will say, "Get upset." You know, who do you think you are, trying to take away this thing that?
Obviously, yeah.
Yeah, and my instinct, which actually works well in life, is to say, "Well, we agree." You think we disagree, but we actually agree, because you wouldn't be angry unless you thought we were talking about something very important. Like if I said, you know, I wrote this book about why we should drink sparkling water instead of still water, and I'd like to try to persuade you all to drink sparkling water. People who drink still water wouldn't stand up and get angry at me. They would just think it was boring, or they would walk out and not care. But people get angry about this subject because it matters, and we know that it matters. In the most like fundamental way, it's a question of life or death. That's not an opinion, it's just the truth. Meat involves death. There's no way around that. But it also involves who we are as humans, and it involves our culture, our familial culture, our national culture. For some people, their religious culture. And that, for very good reasons, makes us sensitive. The other reason I didn't bring it up until I felt that I had established a kind of conversation was that, for no good reason at all, it sort of embarrasses me to talk about. I've noticed that if I'm at dinner, mm-hmm. At a dinner party, let's say at friends, and they say, "Oh my God, I forgot that you're a vegetarian." That doesn't really happen anymore because I wrote a book.
Yeah.
But
two.
But I am in awkward situations very often. I was just 10 minutes ago, you heard backstage, yeah. when we were talking about what to eat, and you know, somebody wanted to eat meat, and I said, "Go ahead, I'm not judging anybody." It's not, but that kind of situation happens all the time, and I feel an embarrassment because I don't want to make people uncomfortable. I don't want anybody to feel judged. On the other hand, I don't want to be embarrassed about something that I think is right, you know? So in this book and in the conversations that I have about it, it's a balancing act.
When Eating Animals came out, that's 10 years ago, I think the situation was also different somehow. If you went to a restaurant, the only vegetarian dish they had was mushroom risotto most of the time, which is not vegan at all because then you have the Parmesan cheese on top of it. Mm. And now it has changed a little bit. It's a little bit more easy to go to a restaurant and go for the vegan or the vegetarian choice. But how long do you think will it take until you won't feel embarrassed or that people won't feel that they embarrass you when they eat meat around you? Or how long do you think it will take for this to be normal?
Well, I think it is normal now. You know, when I started this book, which only came out a few months ago, and I maybe started it only a year and a half ago, there was not a fast food restaurant in America that had a veggie burger or anything that was vegetarian. Now, there's not a fast food restaurant in America that doesn't have a veggie burger. Beyond Meat, maybe you've heard of the Beyond Burger, was the most successful IPO in the last 20 years of the American stock market. And it's not just about meat. You know, Tesla is now the most successful American car company in American history. The trends are obviously moving very, very much in the direction of like sensitivity to these things. And I think one of the changes which makes it, which in a way takes the pressure off of the psychology that's at stake and makes it less embarrassing, is that it's not actually vegetarians that made Beyond Meat so successful. 80% of people who buy Beyond Burgers are meat eaters. And we're moving away from a world in which you're a vegetarian or you're not, or you're a vegan or you're not. In America, we actually don't even really use the word vegan anymore.
No?
No. People say plant-based, you know.
I'm plant-based, they say.
You're not plant-based, but eat a plant-based diet. Yeah.
It's an interesting approach. There's, if I get this correctly, there's impossible meats that will simulate the meat, right? And then there's Beyond Burger that will do a food a plant-based patty.
Is that, no, they're the no. same.
They're the both. Same. Okay.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But there's also the approach to just simulate meat, making use of animal cells and then producing it in the laboratory.
Yeah, that's not in the public. No. I mean, they don't. Nobody.
It's too expensive
that.
By now. Do you have a? Do you think? Do you have a preference
between what?
Between Impossible Burger and the Beyond Meat? Like, if we go to the States, what shall we eat?
You should try each and decide for yourself. Okay. I think they're both good. I mean, to tell you the truth, I don't eat a whole lot of that.
Okay.
I find that there's just more than enough great other things to eat. I eat a diet that is probably close to what my parents and my grandparents and my great-grandparents and my great-grandparents ate, which is some rice, some beans, some vegetables, maybe some lentils. There's a million things in the world to eat that aren't meat. It wasn't until very recently that we started eating the amount of meat that we do. Mm. The amount of meat and dairy that we consume in the world right now is the equivalent of every person alive in the year 1700 eating 900 pounds of meat and drinking 1,200 gallons of milk every day. So obviously a lot of that is because the population has gotten so much bigger, and a lot of it is also because our notion of what a meal is has really changed. You know, our notion of a meal now for most people is that two-thirds of the plate is going to be a piece of animal protein of one kind or another. And we are the first roomful, this is the first generation or two to have thought of a meal that way.
It's so interesting why meat has become such an important part, basically, of the macho culture as well. I think last week it was that the Trump administration said that they're going to change the lunch for school children again. Michelle Obama had this as a signature achievement that she brought on more vegetables and more plants into the diet of school children, and now the Trump administration is reversing that and putting burger again on the menu of the schools. Why is burger so important to people like Trump?
I think I really think analyzing him is a waste of time.
Okay.
Trump is not a representative of the United States
okay.
in the most literal sense. 3 million more people voted for somebody else. We have an unusual electoral system where somebody can win even though they received 3 million fewer votes. He's also not a representative of American values. 91% of Americans accept the science of climate mm-hmm. change. 70% of Americans wanted the United States to remain in the Paris Climate Accords. And he's certainly not a representative of youth and what young people want to eat. On American college campuses, and I don't just mean in New York or in Berkeley, the entire country, there are more vegetarians than Catholics. So it's not a fringe identity. You know, when I was in college, there were more vegetarians than would admit to it because it had more of that quality of embarrassment that I was talking about. And it was aesthetically a little bit weird, you know? Now there are more people who admit to it than who are actually vegetarian. Because like, Beyonce's vegan. Why wouldn't everybody want to be vegan if Beyonce's vegan?
But plant-based.
Plant-based, yes. You know, the Golden Globes this year were vegan.
Uh-huh.
Joaquin Phoenix, who won the Best Actor at the Golden Globes, got up and gave a speech about why we need to eat less meat for the sake of the environment. The leading chefs in America are talking about why we need to eat less meat. It's really... You can feel the cultural conversation shifting very, very, very quickly. Like it's approaching that moment that I think everybody knows is going to happen, after which we will look back and say, why did we ever do it that way? I can't believe we used to do it that way.
So we are better than we think we are already, somehow?
Well, we think we're pretty good in America, so it's complicated.
What struck me about your book is this non-lecturing approach that you have, and then you presented it on stage here as well, that you don't tell people what to do, or you don't want to tell people what to do. You don't wag a finger at your reader or at your audience. Did this come naturally to you? Because it's a subject that you can also, as you mentioned yourself, get very angry about and get very emotional about.
They're different parts of me. You know, there's a part of me that when I think about this subject, I want to say, oh no, this is really wrong. This is really wrong, wrong, wrong. And when we talk about it in terms of moderation or relativism, we are doing an injustice to ourselves. We are pretending that something is acceptable that is not acceptable. But then I look at myself and my own hypocrisies and my own inability to live up to my own ideals. And so I have to say, who would I be? You know, to say to somebody else, you have to do this thing. And there have been times in my life when I have said to other people, you should do a thing that I am not doing. And that's not a good path forward. So in terms of just the climate, because mm-hmm. this is a book about the climate rather than about meat per se, the climate does not require that we all be perfect. The climate does not require that we stop flying or stop driving or stop having children or stop eating animal products, but it requires that we do them a lot less. So instead of thinking about it as an absolute or as a binary, like either I will do it or I won't do it, I think we should try to be responsive to what's necessary. And we have a very good idea of what is necessary. The most comprehensive analysis of the relationship between meat and climate change was published at the end of 2018. And the authors, it was a team of scientists who studied food systems all over the planet. And what they concluded was that while people who live in certain malnourished parts of the world, like parts of Africa or Asia, they could afford to eat a little bit more meat and a little bit more dairy. Citizens of Europe and the UK and the United States have to eat 90% less meat, 90, and 60% less dairy in order to avoid what the authors called catastrophic, irreversible climate catastrophe. So that's, those are big numbers, and that's a big sentence, but it's a reminder of our situation. You know, it'd be great if we didn't have the situation, but we do. We created it, sometimes unknowingly, sometimes knowingly, and now we have to choose either to fix it or just to throw our hands up in the air and say, we're not willing to try. But if we're willing to try, it does not mean that we have to stop eating these foods altogether. And it doesn't actually mean that we have to eat 90% less tomorrow. I had a really wonderful conversation with Cristiana Figueres, who is the former UN climate chief. And she said, look, we constantly overestimate how much we can do in 1 year, and we underestimate what we can do in a decade. In a decade, we need to reduce carbon emissions by 60%. That sounds like a lot, but if you break it up, you know, can you reduce it by 6% this year? Can you reduce it by 6% the next year? I suspect, I mean, this is obviously an unusual audience because you decided to come here tonight, but I suspect that most people in Zurich, let's say, if you were to say, could you become a vegetarian for the sake of the climate, they would say no, if they're being honest. But if you were to ask them, can you reduce your consumption of animal products by 9% this year? I think most people would find that possible, even if it was challenging. I think they would at the very least begin to think about what that would mean. You know, how many meals a week would I have to eat less? Could I just cut out my breakfast? Or what if I just cut out lunch? Or what if I didn't do it on the weekends? People would start to become creative and make concrete something that was otherwise abstract.
So we go at it like the anonymous alcoholics that we always try every day with a short step?
Well, I think there's an easier way to do it, which is what I suggest, which is you just have a plan and you don't make it a decision at every meal. I had a very moving experience. I did a reading in Brussels about maybe 3 months ago, and there was a signing afterwards. And a young couple came up to me, they were maybe 20 years old or so, and they handed me the book to sign, but the page was filled with their handwriting. And I asked them what it was. And they said, well, we're going to get married in a couple of months, and we decided tonight that we need to have a plan for what we're going to do when we're married, because if we don't have a plan, we'll just keep doing what we've always done, which is what everybody does. And their plan that they wrote down was, we will not have more than 2 children. We will eat as vegetarians unless we're served meat at a friend's house and there's no option. We will eat as vegans 2 days a week, and we will only do car sharing and only 1,500 kilometers per year. And then instead of just having me sign it, they had a line that said witness. That they wanted to sign it. And I had the same response that you just did. I kind of chuckled. I thought it was very charming. It was nice to have an insight into how these two people live. Like, oh, they want to do this, but they value when their friends cook. I get that. That's interesting. They want to have kids, but they also understand that we need to control the population. And then I suddenly felt like really flushed with shame, because I realized that even though they came to my book reading, and even though I was signing the book, and even though I expect my government to have a plan, and I talk about it all the time, and I expect corporations to have a plan, and I expect the school that my kids go to have a plan, I didn't have a plan. I just didn't have a plan. I would say things like, I'm going to try to fly less in 2020. And that statement is worth nothing at all. It's just worth nothing, because what does that mean? You know, when you plan a vacation, you hope that you remember, and you hope that you have the necessary feelings. So I went home to my hotel and I wrote out my plan, which I usually have in my book, and I do here right now, actually, and which was to eat vegan for breakfast and lunch. And
it's your day plan? Do you do one for every day, or do you?
No, this is my life plan.
Life plan.
All right, for 2020, in any case.
Okay.
Eat vegan for breakfast and lunch, vegetarian for dinner, and if I can eat vegan for dinner, I do that too. And at home, I can. I always can. It's really only an issue if I go out, and even then it's often not an issue. No flying for vacations in 2020. limit cab rides to 3 a week, which in New York is its own thing, and then devote one full day a week to volunteering for an organization I quite like called 350.org, and going to New York City public schools and talking to students. And having a plan really changed me, both because it kept me honest. You know, it's just too easy to say, I'm going to change. I'm going to fly less. Yeah, for sure. Oh, yeah. And nobody ever challenges you on it, and you don't challenge yourself on it, and it doesn't amount to anything. Having a plan, I've shown it to people. I talk about it.
He signed it himself, by the way.
I did, yeah. I had it up on our refrigerator for a little while. I just don't fly for vacations now, because how can I? Because I said it. And it spares me from having to have thoughts and feelings. It makes me a creature of habit. Like, if you go to a store and you see something that you like, that you would like to own, why don't you steal it? You know, I assume you never steal it, right? Probably nobody in this.
I'm not good at stealing.
You're not good at saying? I doubt that's the reason. You
know, so. No, I'm scared, I guess.
Is that why?
No, no, it's wrong. Yeah. I don't know. Well, it's a good question.
I should ask somebody else.
Help me out.
Most people would say they don't steal because I just don't steal.
Oh, okay.
It's like that simple. I'm just not somebody who steals, you know? Like, for me, I don't have to remember anything. I don't have to remember the social contract. And I don't have to have any feelings at all. My heart doesn't have to expand when I think about the shop owner. I just don't steal because I just don't steal. That's just who I am. I just don't steal. And so we need to make ourselves into people who don't steal from the planet and who don't steal from the future. And if we have to have big ideas and big feelings every time we make a choice, I can speak for myself, I wouldn't be able to do it. But if I say I'm just not going to fly for vacations, I just won't fly for vacations because I'm somebody who just doesn't fly for vacations. So if you take nothing else away from tonight, I would really, really strongly encourage you to make a plan and to do it with, if you have a partner, or do it with your kids, talk about it, show it to people, put it on your refrigerator. We know the four most important things to do as individuals with regard to the climate are flying, driving, eating, and having children. So just say what your idea is for those four things in 2020. You know, like give it days of the week or month. This is how many times I'm going to fly. This is what I'm going to eat.
See, everybody starts discussing already. But
it's so funny because it's so simple, so simple. It will change your life, and it never occurred to me until somebody showed me. It just never occurred to me.
Well, another thing that I really liked about your book is that you look at the subject from a novelist's eye, and I'm not sure if I would have read another climate change or global warning book. But this is, I think, because you have such a mixture of approaches. And to hear how this will sound, we have a special guest star tonight. The actress Ariella Saalbacher will come up and read from the German version that was published by Kiepenheuer & Witsch. Please welcome Ariella Saalbacher.
Keine gute Story. Am 2. März 1955 stieg eine schwarze Amerikanerin in Montgomery, Alabama, in einen Bus und weigerte sich, ihren Platz einem Weißen zu überlassen. So gut wie jedes amerikanische Kind könnte diese Szene überzeugend nachspielen, genau wie es das erste Thanksgiving nachstellen, Teebeutel von einem Pappschiff werfen oder in einem selbstgebastelten Zylinder die Gettysburg Address aufsagen könnte und wüsste, was all das bedeutet. Wahrscheinlich glauben Sie, den Namen dieser ersten Frau zu kennen, die im Bus nicht hinten sitzen wollte, aber wahrscheinlich liegen Sie falsch. So ging es auch mir, bis mich kürzlich jemand aufklärte. Mit Zufall hat das allerdings nichts zu tun. In gewisser Hinsicht konnte die Bürgerrechtsbewegung nur dadurch triumphieren, dass man Claudette Colvin vergaß. Die größte Gefahr für menschliches Leben, die kombinierte Bedrohung aus immer heftigeren Superstürmen und ansteigendem Meeresspiegel, immer heftigeren Dürren und zunehmendem Wassermangel, immer größeren Totwasserzonen in den Ozeanen, massiver Verbreitung schädlicher Insekten und dem täglichen Verschwinden von Wäldern und Tierarten ist für die meisten Leute keine gute Story. Sofern die Krise des Planeten uns überhaupt interessiert, dann als ein Krieg, der da drüben ausgefochten wird. Wir kennen die Dringlichkeit der Lage, wissen um die existenzielle Gefahr, doch obwohl wir wissen, dass da ein Krieg um unser Überleben tobt, geht er uns gefühlt nichts an. Dieser Abstand zwischen Bewusstsein und Gefühl macht es oft selbst klugen, engagierten Leuten, die gerne etwas tun wollen, schwer, wirklich aktiv zu werden. Wenn die Bomber direkt über einen hinweg dröhnen, wie während des Kriegs in London, löscht man das Licht ganz automatisch. Fallen die Bomben vor der Küste, sieht das schon anders aus, obwohl die Gefahr letztlich genauso groß ist. Fallen sie jenseits eines Ozeans, kann es schwierig werden, überhaupt an das Bombardement zu glauben, auch wenn man davon weiß. Wenn wir abwarten, bis wir die Krise spüren, die wir merkwürdigerweise eine der Umwelt nennen, so als wäre die Zerstörung unseres Planeten nichts als Kontext, werden wir irgendwann ein Problem anpacken, das sich längst nicht mehr lösen lässt. Noch weiter da drüben wirkt die Krise, weil sie unsere Vorstellungskraft übersteigt. Über Ausmaß und Komplexität dieser Bedrohung nachzudenken, ist extrem anstrengend. Wir wissen, dass der Klimawandel mit Luftverschmutzung zu tun hat, mit CO2, mit der Meerestemperatur, dem Regenwald, den Polkappen. Den meisten von uns dürfte es jedoch schwer fallen zu erklären, wie unser individuelles und kollektives Verhalten Wirbelstürme um fast 50 Stundenkilometer beschleunigt oder zu einem Polarwirbel beiträgt, durch den es in Chicago kälter wird als in der Antarktis. Und es fällt uns schwer, nicht zu vergessen, wie sehr die Welt sich schon verändert hat. Wir staunen gar nicht mehr über den Vorschlag, Manhattan mit einer 15 Kilometer langen Hochwasserschutzmauer zu umgeben, nehmen höhere Versicherungsbeiträge hin und extreme Wetterphänomene, Waldbrände vor den Toren von Großstädten, alljährliche Jahrhundertfluten, Rekordtodeszahlen bei Rekordhitzewellen sind in unseren Augen einfach nur noch Wetter. Die Geschichte von der Krise unseres Planeten ist schwierig zu erzählen und obendrein ist sie nicht gut. Nicht bloß überzeugt sie uns nicht, sie interessiert uns nicht einmal. Aufmerksamkeit fesseln und Veränderung bewirken, das ist das wichtigste Bestreben von Kunst und politischem Aktivismus. Das Thema Klimawandel schlägt sich in beiden Bereichen schlecht. Bezeichnenderweise nimmt das Schicksal unseres Planeten in der Literatur noch weniger Raum ein als im übrigen kulturellen Austausch und das, obwohl die meisten Schriftsteller sich für besonders sensibel gegenüber der unterrepräsentierten Wahrheiten dieser Welt halten. Vielleicht liegt das daran, dass Schriftsteller außerdem besonders sensibel dafür sind, welche Geschichten funktionieren. Die Narrationen, die in unserer Kultur Bestand haben, Volksmärchen, religiöse Texte, Mythen, gewisse historische Berichte verfügen über abgeschlossene Handlungen, eindeutige Schurken und Helden, spektakuläre Action und eine klare Moral. Daher die Neigung, den Klimawandel, wenn überhaupt, als zukünftige Apokalypse darzustellen, statt als veränderbaren Prozess, und die Brennstoffindustrie als leibhaftiges Verderben, statt als einen von vielen Faktoren, die wir angehen müssen. Die Krise unseres Planeten ist so abstrakt und vielschichtig, verläuft so langsam, ermangelt so sehr symbolträchtigen Gestalten und Momenten, dass es unmöglich scheint, sie fesselnd und wahrhaftig zu beschreiben. Claudette Colvin war die erste Frau, die verhaftet wurde, weil sie in Montgomery ihren Platz im Bus nicht aufgeben wollte. Rosa Parks, deren Namen wir fast alle kennen, trat erst 9 Monate später auf den Plan. Und als sie sich im Bus gegen die Rassentrennung wehrte, war sie keineswegs bloß eine erschöpfte Näherin, die nach einem langen Arbeitstag nach Hause wollte. Sie war eine gewiefte Bürgerrechtlerin, Schriftführerin ihres Ortsverbands, der NAACP, hatte an Seminaren zu sozialer Gerechtigkeit teilgenommen, mit einflussreichen Anwälten zu Mittag gegessen und die Strategie der Bewegung mitgeplant. Parks war 42, verheiratet, kam aus gutem Hause. Colvin war 15, schwanger von einem älteren, verheirateten Mann und stammte aus armen Verhältnissen. Führende Bürgerrechtler, auch Rosa Parks selbst, empfanden ihren Lebenslauf als zu gebrochen, ihren Charakter als zu labil für eine Heldin der entstehenden Bewegung. Sie hätte einfach nicht für eine ausreichend gute Story getaugt. Hätte das Christentum sich derart ausgebreitet, wenn man Jesus nicht gekreuzigt, sondern in der Badewanne ertränkt hätte? Würden so viele Menschen Anne Franks Tagebuch lesen, wenn sie ein mittelalter Mann gewesen wäre, der sich hinter einem Kleiderschrank versteckte, statt eines bildhübschen Mädchens hinter einem Bücherregal? In welchem Ausmaß wurde die Geschichte von Lincolns Zylinder beeinflusst, von Gandhis Lendenschurz, Hitlers Schnurrbart, Van Goghs Ohr, Martin Luthers Stimme und dem Umstand, dass kein Gebäude der Welt sich leichter zeichnen ließ als die Türme des World Trade Centers? Rosa Parks Story ist zugleich historische Episode und ein Märchen mit dem Zweck, Geschichte zu schreiben. Wie die symbolträchtigen Fotos der Soldaten, die auf Iwo Jima die amerikanische Flagge hissen, des Paars in Robert Doisneaus Le Baiser de l'Hôtel de Ville und des Milchmanns im zerbombten London, war auch das Foto von Rosa Parks im Bus gestellt. Der Mann auf der Bank hinter ihr ist kein wütender Verteidiger der Rassentrennung, sondern ein befreundeter Journalist. Und wie sie später einräumte, war die ganze Sache weniger simpel, weniger denkwürdig, als dass eine erschöpfte Frau sich im Bus nach hinten setzen sollte. Doch weil sie die Macht von Geschichten kannte, gab Parks den Ereignissen eine möglichst ergreifende Form. Als Heldin ihrer Story war Parks mutig, als deren Co-Autorin war sie heldenhaft. Geschichte wird im Nachhinein zu einer guten Story und gute Stories werden zu Geschichte. Hinsichtlich des Schicksals unseres Planeten und damit des Schicksals der Menschheit ist das ein echtes Problem. Wie es der Meeresbiologe und Filmemacher Randy Olson ausdrückte, Klima ist sehr wahrscheinlich das langweiligste Thema, das die Wissenschaft der Öffentlichkeit je hat näherbringen müssen. Die meisten Versuche, von der Krise zu erzählen, sind entweder Science Fiction oder werden als solche abgetan. Kaum eine Version der Geschichte vom Klimawandel ließe sich im Kindergarten nachspielen. Keine würde die Eltern dort zu Tränen rühren. Es scheint ganz unmöglich, die Katastrophe aus dem da drüben unserer Köpfe ins hier bei uns unserer Herzen zu holen. In den Worten Amitav Ghosh in seinem Buch Die große Verblendung: Die Klimakrise ist auch eine Krise der Kultur und deshalb eine der Imagination. Ich würde es Glaubenskrise nennen. Danke.
So you know what she wrote, I guess, what she read. Did you understand any of it?
Yeah.
Yeah? You know, when the people laugh. So there's always the question of a heroine of a hero when you have a good story, but wouldn't somebody like Greta Thunberg, for example, make a good heroine? What do you think?
Yeah, I think she makes an excellent heroine. And that's why she's been so important. Mm-hmm. In fact, when I was writing this book, she had not yet surfaced on the scene. Somebody asked me earlier today why I didn't mention her mm-hmm. in the book. And it was only because she wasn't really on my mind when I was writing the book, because she wasn't on anybody's mind. And that's a testament, actually, to how quickly things are changing. Mm-hmm. You know, there's an old joke about two fish who meet one day in the ocean, and one says, "The water's rather warm today, don't you think?" And the other one says, "What the hell is water?" because we have no... It's very hard to be aware of your own context. And can you imagine there was a time, like 2 years ago, when you wouldn't have known who Greta Thunberg was? It's incredible. Can you imagine... I mean... there have been so many very, very dramatic changes in the last year, even in the last 6 months. I never, ever would have imagined that the Golden Globes would be vegan for environmental reasons, and that all the celebrities walking down the red carpet would then have to talk about it, and would be eager to talk about it, in fact. I think that there are her entrance onto the scene as a reason to be encouraged. And by the way, so is Donald Trump's, in a very different way, of course. But
makes a good antagonist.
He makes a good antagonist. And it's very helpful to have an antagonist. It's good to fight in a war when you can imagine the enemy. And he has...
Maybe he's doing it for the good of the globe.
I don't think he is, but it hardly matters. You know, I really wanted Hillary to be president. And I worked for her campaign, and I, of course, voted for her. And I couldn't have been more disappointed when she lost. If she had been president, the United States would have remained in the Paris Climate Accords. But just like Switzerland, and just like Germany, and just like Italy, and just like France, and just like Spain, and the United Kingdom, and every single country in Europe, and every country in North America, and every country in South America, we would not have been on pace to meet the goals of the Paris Climate Accords. Only Gambia and Morocco are on pace to meet the goals of the Paris Climate Accords. So how good should we feel about having our signature on that empty document? And how angry should we actually feel at Trump for removing the United States? What I mean when I say that is not that Trump isn't deserving of anger. Mm-hmm. What I mean is we should use our emotions in the places that they're more useful and more deserved. And some of that, some of it, is certainly at our leaders for having failed us and continuing to fail us. And some of it has to be directed at ourselves because we are not governments and we cannot do what governments can do. And we require governments to regulate industry and to regulate us in ways that will make make it possible to solve this problem, but we are also complicit in the problem. And individual actions cannot save the planet, but the planet can't be saved without individual actions.
And anger maybe though, isn't it? I found this quite interesting because in Germany we have a sort of a generational conflict that the younger generation, the ones, the teenagers that go to strike on the street on a Friday, they are angry at their parents and their grandparents for their lifestyle, for their greed, for meat and travel and luxury. And I was talking to Matthias about this, and he said it's a little bit different in Switzerland. There's not so much of a generational conflict, and people don't criticize the older generation as much. How is that in the States? Do you have the same conflict? Are the young people really angry?
I don't think the young people are yet as mobilized.
Okay.
Or as activated as they are in Europe. We're getting there, but we're not there
yet. Does your son go on a strike?
Yeah, everybody goes on a strike, but why wouldn't you? You know, like you get the day off of school and it's fun and you hang out with friends and you get to chant and it feels good. And there is a danger in a certain kind of environmental participation which can be confused for enough action.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I myself experience this all the time. The feeling of, you know, you say somebody has to do something as if saying that we're doing something. Or you watch the news at night. That's in America, we have like liberal media and conservative media and nothing in between. So you watch the liberal media at night and it talks about what a jerk Trump is. And then you turn it off and you say, well, I've done my political duty,
Yeah. You
know? And we have to, it's a very, very good thing and necessary thing to march. I'm not disparaging that, but it can't be the only thing that we do.
Is this why you're proposing so much the individual approach? I mean, your book is basically not, you're not addressing politicians, they should do something, but as you said yourself, you address a we or us, that we should change. Is that why you want the individual approach?
Well, it was a very personal book. And I don't know that I was endorsing an approach per se. I'm not in a position to do that. But I am an expert of myself, and so I wanted to, you know, explore this very personal situation that I was describing in the beginning of how to close the distance between what I know and what I do. I also don't have faith in our leaders, not right now. And I don't just mean Trump. You know, among the Democratic candidates running for president, none of them are giving us any reason to think that they will do what's necessary. At the same time, I wouldn't be surprised if they surprised us, you know, once elected, because they do have to get elected first. I have some amount of faith in the humanity of somebody like Elizabeth Warren or Bernie Sanders, but they're certainly not talking about a kind of action that's on the scale of the problem. So, but there's one point that I would make, which is that individual action is both important because it is significant, the ways that we can shrink our carbon footprints. And when you multiply those individual actions, you're talking about an enormous reduction in greenhouse gas emissions. But it's at least as important in another way, which is individual actions. There's almost no such thing as an individual action anymore. You know, we live in a world in which our choices are tracked more than they ever have been in history. And that's by and large a terrible thing. But one way in which it's good is it makes political acts that we take, especially when they involve dollars, noticed. So if you start eating fewer animal products, Google will know, Facebook will know, Amazon will know, the buying chains for restaurants will know. It's not a coincidence that Burger King sells Beyond Burgers. It's not because the government required them to, and it's not because the CEOs had a revelation and awoke and said, let's be part of the solution instead of part of the problem. It's because people, individuals, said, I'm going to do that. I'm going to, and again, mostly meat eaters, said, I'm going to try to eat less because I believe in science. You know, it's like that simple, because I believe that science is our best understanding of our contemporary reality. So while we make these choices, we are also influencing the marketplace and we're influencing the political culture. There's a reason politicians are talking about climate change so much right now. It's because they want our votes. And we have made it clear that our votes are at least somewhat dependent on them being engaged with this crisis.
What did bring this change about? I mean, there, you said yourself, there's a new urgency in the climate crisis. How come? I mean,
well, there's a million, you know, the climate crisis was caused by thousands of factors, and it will be solved by thousands of factors. There's a temptation to look for the thing that will finally fix it or put us on the right path, when there will be many things. But we can single out a few, and I think Greta Thunberg has been the most important. She's just awakened our consciousness in a way that nobody had been able to.
But also because we somehow constructed her, if I understand you correctly, with your comparison to Rosa Parks.
No, I don't think we constructed her.
But we
How
wished
could we
her
have?
To be. No, I wished her to be a hero, too.
Well, she arrived at the right moment, and she satisfied, she spoke to something inside of us. Rosa Parks was, you know, as in that passage, was in part, and this does nothing to diminish her heroism. In fact, in my mind, it furthers her heroism. She was a creation of the NAACP, and she participated in that creation. They said, what is the most effective way that we can tell this story so that it will inspire the most number of people? Greta Thunberg did not come like that. She was a child who skipped school and protested in front of the parliament. She has a singular charisma and a way of speaking that many people, including myself, respond very strongly to. But she cannot be the only spokesperson. She can't be the only messenger. It is not only incredibly unfair to her, because she's a human being after all, but it won't work. You know, if you go to a bookstore, there are thousands of novels. You know, why isn't there just one novel? It's because different people are reached by different stories. Different people are inspired or moved or activated by different kinds of stories. And it's going to be the same thing. It is already the same thing with the climate. We need to approach it from every angle possible. And it's extremely important that we have a messenger like Greta Thunberg. It's also extremely important that each of us becomes a messenger in our own homes, around our dinner tables, in our circles of friends, and at our workplaces.
Speaking of novels, did it not inspire you to write a novel maybe about the climate crisis? I mean, you chose to write a nonfiction. You could have just as well written a novel. Why did you choose to do nonfiction about climate crisis?
I couldn't. You're asking me as if I could. Okay. I couldn't. I don't.
Okay. I believe in you. I think you could. No, okay.
Well, I appreciate that. Unfortunately, it doesn't help.
No. It could be my plan.
Yeah. I don't know how to.
Is it too tough a subject? Or I mean,
it's a very, very difficult subject to write about without it being, as we just heard, either science fiction. Uh-huh. Or seeming like it's science fiction.
Apocalyptic or something, it had to be, yeah.
And then what? Then it's entertaining, actually. You know, the function of novels is to change people, mm-hmm. but through, it's also necessary to entertain them. Because if you're not entertained, you won't read the book, you won't be engaged with it. Nonfiction also does have some responsibility to entertain, but it's a very different kind of entertaining. It's more of like an intellectual engagement than a visceral engagement. But you know, this book has a lot of different styles inside of it. And there are moments when I felt very novelistic, and there are moments when it felt more like memoir, and there are moments that are very science-based. I think the book reflects the kind of complexity of my feelings about the subject. You know, sometimes I think about climate change as a consumer of information. Sometimes I think about it as a father. Sometimes I think about it as a 42-year-old. Sometimes I think about it as an American. Sometimes I think about it as a Jewish person. I bring all of those.
All different approaches?
Yeah. I mean, but that's who we are. That's how we address the big problems in our lives and the good things in our lives as well. So I was lucky in that, as I said before, I'm not an expert of anything here except for myself. So I didn't have to pretend to be an expert of anything. I didn't have to write it as a, you know, using the voice of like a journalist. I didn't have to write it performing as a scientist. I was just writing it with the kind of fullness of my different mix of identities.
It's a very different mix of styles. I think this is really what makes the book also very interesting. There's a discussion with the soul. There's sometimes you just have bullet points thrown at you with various facts. But what I found really compelling is that there's a sort of a sadness in your book as well. You sort of mourn the planet that is already somehow lost. And you connect that with a personal story. But you leave us some hope, and that brings me to the second reading of Ariella. Thank you.
Handzeichen. Dieses Buch handelt von den Auswirkungen landwirtschaftlicher Tierhaltung auf die Umwelt. Und doch habe ich diesen Umstand 77 Seiten lang verschleiert. Ich habe das Thema aus denselben Gründen umschifft wie Gore und viele andere vor mir, aus Angst, dass sich damit kein Blumentopf gewinnen lässt. Ich bin sogar ausgewichen, während ich Gore für sein Ausweichen kritisierte. Ich habe nie konkret benannt, was er verschweigt. Wie Gore wohl auch, hielt ich das für die beste Strategie. Diskussionen über Fleisch, Eier und Milchprodukte bringen die Leute auf die Barrikaden. Sie gehen ihnen auf die Nerven. Kein Nicht-Veganer hat darauf große Lust, und der Eifer der Veganer kann einem noch den letzten Spaß daran verderben. Aber wir haben keine Chance, dem Klimawandel Einhalt zu gebieten, wenn wir nicht offen über seine Ursachen sprechen und darüber, wie wir uns ändern können. Manchmal muss man eine Faust mit Faust beschriften, weshalb ich jetzt das Kind beim Namen nenne. Wenn wir den Planeten retten wollen, müssen wir deutlich weniger Tierprodukte konsumieren. Dieses Buch plädiert dafür, dass wir alle anders essen. Soll heißen, keine tierischen Produkte vor dem Abend. Eine schwierige Forderung, sowohl weil das Thema so belastet ist, als auch wegen des verlangten Opfers. Die meisten Menschen mögen den Geruch und den Geschmack von Fleisch, Eiern und Milchprodukten. Die meisten Menschen haben zu fast jeder Mahlzeit tierische Produkte konsumiert und das seit ihrer Kindheit und sie wollen keine neuen Essidentitäten annehmen. Die meisten Menschen haben Tierprodukte ihr ganzes Leben lang bei fast jeder Mahlzeit gegessen und lebenslange Gewohnheiten lassen sich schwer ablegen, erst recht, wenn man damit so viel Genuss und Selbstbilder verknüpft sind. Das sind große Hürden, die man nicht nur anerkennen sollte, sondern muss. Verglichen damit, auf der ganzen Welt die Stromerzeugung umzustellen, den Einfluss mächtiger Lobbyisten auf Emissionsgesetze zu überwinden oder ein brauchbares internationales Abkommen über Treibhausgase zu ratifizieren, ist anders Essen ein Kinderspiel. Aber einfach ist es nicht. Mit Anfang 30 habe ich 3 Jahre lang über Massentierhaltung recherchiert und ein ganzes Buch dagegen geschrieben unter dem Titel »Tiere essen«. Dann habe ich fast 2 Jahre lang hunderte Lesungen, Vorträge und Interviews zu dem Thema gegeben und den Standpunkt vertreten, man solle kein Fleisch aus Massentierhaltung essen. Es wäre daher viel leichter für mich zu verschweigen, dass ich im Laufe der letzten Jahre in schwierigen Zeiten einige schwere private Veränderungen und eine Lesereise mit einem neuen Roman zu einer Zeit, in der ich zur Selbstvermarktung ganz und gar nicht in der Lage war, mehrmals Fleisch gegessen habe. Meistens Burger, häufig an Flughäfen, sprich Fleisch aus genau der Art Viehzucht, gegen die ich mich am nachdrücklichsten ausgesprochen hatte. Der Grund macht meine Heuchelei nur noch erbärmlicher. Es tat einfach gut. Ich kann mir lebhaft vorstellen, wie manche Leute angesichts dieser Beichte bissige Kommentare abgeben und die Augen verdrehen und wie andere mir triumphierend Hochstapelei vorwerfen. Manche sind vielleicht auch ehrlich bestürzt. Ich habe doch so ausführlich und leidenschaftlich beschrieben, wie Massentierhaltung Tiere quält und die Umwelt zerstört. Wie kann ich radikalen Wandel fordern und meine Kinder zu Vegetariern erziehen und zugleich Fleisch essen, nur weil es gut tut? Ich wünschte, ich hätte woanders Trost gefunden, bei etwas, das mir dauerhaft gut getan und meinen Überzeugungen nicht widersprochen hätte. Aber ich bin, wer ich bin und tat, was ich tat. Selbst während der Arbeit an diesem Buch, die mich in meiner ursprünglich des Tierwohls wegen getroffenen Entscheidung zum Vegetarismus nur bestärkte, verging kaum ein Tag, an dem ich nicht nach Fleisch lechzte. Hin und wieder habe ich mich gefragt, ob meine wachsende intellektuelle Ablehnung von Fleisch meinen Körper nur immer stärker danach verlangen ließ. Dann lernte ich zu akzeptieren, dass zwar Handlungen einigermaßen dem Willen unterworfen sein mögen, Gelüste aber nicht. Woran es auch gelegen haben mag, ich verspürte oft eine Version von Felix Frankfurters Wissen ohne Glauben, die mir viele Mühen abverlangte und mich manchmal ganz schön heuchlerisch werden ließ. Es ist mir fast unerträglich peinlich, das hier zuzugeben, aber es muss sein. Während ich mit Tiere essen auf Lesereise war, wurde ich oft gefragt, warum ich nicht vegan lebe. Die Argumente Tierwohl und Umweltschutz gelten für Eier und Milchprodukte schließlich mindestens genauso wie für Fleisch, oft sogar noch mehr. Manchmal redete ich mich damit heraus, wie schwer es sei, für 2 nörgelnde Kinder zu kochen. Manchmal bog ich mir die Wahrheit zurecht und nannte mich quasi vegan. In Wahrheit war mir die ehrliche Antwort nur zu peinlich. Meine Lust auf Käse und Eier war größer als meine Bereitschaft, Tierquälerei und Umweltzerstörung zu verhindern. in gewisser Hinsicht war es entlastend, von anderen Leuten etwas zu verlangen, zu dem ich selbst nicht in der Lage war. Meiner eigenen Scheinheiligkeit ins Angesicht zu sehen, erinnerte mich daran, wie schwer allein schon der Versuch ist, mit offenen Augen durchs Leben zu gehen. Zu wissen, dass es schwer wird, macht die Mühen erträglicher. Mühen, nicht Mühe. Ich kann mir keine Zukunft vorstellen, in der ich wieder Fleischesser werde, aber ich kann mir auch keine vorstellen, in der ich nicht gern Fleisch esse. Bewusst zu essen wird eine der Herausforderungen sein, die mein ganzes Leben begleiten und definieren. Diese Herausforderung sehe ich nicht als Ausdruck meiner Unsicherheit über die richtige Art zu essen, sondern als einen Aspekt der Komplexität des Essens. Man isst nicht nur, um satt zu werden, und man kann seine Gelüste nicht einfach aufgrund von Prinzipien abstellen. Wir essen, um niedere Begierden zu befriedigen, um uns auszudrücken und Gemeinschaft herzustellen. Wir essen mit Mund und Magen, aber auch mit Kopf und Herz. All meine verschiedenen Identitäten, Vater, Sohn, Amerikaner, New Yorker, Progressiver, Jude, Schriftsteller, Umweltschützer, Reisender, Genussmensch, sind beim Essen anwesend und meine Geschichte ebenfalls. Als ich mit 9 Jahren erstmals beschloss, Vegetarier zu werden, war mein Motiv recht einfach: Tieren nicht wehtun. Mit den Jahren änderte sich das, weil die verfügbaren Informationen sich änderten, aber vor allem, weil mein Leben sich änderte. Wie vermutlich bei den meisten Menschen vermehrten diese Identitäten sich mit zunehmendem Alter nur. Die Zeit verwischt ethische Grenzen und schärft den Sinn für die Wirrnisse des Lebens. Hätte ich diese letzten Sätze in der Highschool gelesen, ich hätte sie als schäbige Ausrede verhöhnt: die Wirrnisse des Lebens, aha, und wäre tief enttäuscht gewesen von dem Waschlappen, der ich mal werden würde. Ich bin froh, dass ich damals war, wie ich war, und hoffe, andere junge Leute sind genauso unbeirrbar idealistisch. Aber ich bin auch froh, dass ich jetzt bin, wie ich bin. Nicht, weil es leichter ist, sondern weil es in stärkerem Austausch mit der Welt steht, die ja selbst nicht mehr dieselbe ist, in der ich vor 25 Jahren lebte. An irgendeinem Punkt muss das, was einen ganz allein betrifft, sich mit dem Umstand überschneiden, dass man einer von 7 Milliarden Erdlingen ist. Vielleicht zum ersten Mal in der Geschichte ergibt der Ausdruck »unsere Zeit« nicht mehr viel Sinn. Der Klimawandel ist kein Puzzle auf dem Wohnzimmertisch, mit dem man sich beschäftigen kann, wann immer einem gerade danach ist. Er ist ein brennendes Haus. Je länger wir ihn ignorieren, desto größer wird das Problem. Aufgrund diverser Teufelskreise, schmelzendes Eis wird zu dunklem Wasser, das mehr Hitze absorbiert. Tauernder Permafrostboden setzt jede Menge Methan frei, eins der schlimmsten Treibhausgase. Stehen wir kurz vor dem Umschlagpunkt zu einem Dominoeffekt, bei dem wir unrettbar verloren sind. Wir haben nicht den Luxus, in unserer Zeit zu leben. Wir können nicht durchs Leben gehen, als gehöre es nur uns. Mehr als je zuvor erzeugt das Leben, das wir führen, jetzt in unserer Zeit, eine Zukunft, die sich nicht mehr ändern lässt. Stellen Sie sich vor, wenn Lincoln die Sklaverei nicht 1863 abgeschafft hätte, wäre Amerika dazu verurteilt gewesen, auf immer und ewig Menschen zu versklaven. Stellen Sie sich vor, das Recht auf Heirat für gleichgeschlechtliche Paare hätte einzig und für alle Zeiten von Obamas Sinneswandel im Jahr 2012 abgehangen. Wenn Obama von moralischem Fortschritt sprach, zitierte er oft Martin Luther Kings Ausspruch: »Der Bogen des moralischen Universums ist weit, aber er biegt sich zur Gerechtigkeit.« In diesem beispiellosen Augenblick in der Geschichte könnte der Bogen endgültig brechen. An mehreren entscheidenden Momenten in der Bibel fragt Gott einen Menschen, wo er ist. Am häufigsten zitiert wird, wie Adam sich nach dem Biss in die verbotene Frucht versteckt und Gott ihn fragt: »Wo bist du?« Und wie Gott Abraham anruft, bevor er ihm aufträgt, seinen einzigen Sohn zu opfern. Ein allwissender Gott weiß natürlich sowieso, wo seine Geschöpfe sind. Seine Frage bezieht sich nicht auf den Raum, sondern auf das Selbst. Wir haben davon unsere eigene moderne Version. Wenn wir an Momente denken, in denen wir quasi zu Augenzeugen der Geschichte wurden, Pearl Harbor, das Kennedy-Attentat, der Fall der Mauer, der 11. September, fragen wir andere oft, wo sie waren, als es passierte. Wie Gott in der Bibel fragen wir dabei allerdings nicht nach geografischen Koordinaten. Wir fragen nach etwas Tieferem, nach ihrer persönlichen Verbindung zu jenem Augenblick, in der Hoffnung, uns dadurch selber besser auszukennen. Das Wort Krise kommt vom griechischen Krisis, zu Deutsch Entscheidung. Obwohl wir die Umweltkrise alle miterleben, kommt sie uns nicht vor wie ein Ereignis, an dem wir teilnehmen. Sie kommt uns überhaupt nicht vor wie ein Ereignis. Trotz des Traumas von Hurricanes, Waldsterben, Hungersnöten und aussterbenden Arten verleiten Wetterphänomene kaum jemanden, der nicht selbst dabei war, zu Fragen à la »Wo warst du als?« Vielleicht nicht einmal die, die mittendrin steckten. Es ist ja nur Wetter, nur Umwelt. Zukünftige Generationen werden allerdings bestimmt zurückblicken und sich im biblischen Sinne wundern, wo wir damals gewesen sind, zu welchen Entscheidungen die Krise uns veranlasst hat. Warum um alles in der Welt, dieser Welt, wir den Freitod gewählt und sie geopfert haben. Vielleicht könnten wir uns dann darauf berufen, dass die Entscheidung ja gar nicht bei uns lag. So sehr wir auch wollten, wir konnten nichts tun. Wir wussten nicht genug. Als Einzelne hatten wir gar nicht die Mittel, wirklich etwas zu ändern. Die Ölkonzerne gehörten ja nicht uns. Wir machten die Gesetze nicht. Vielleicht könnten wir, wie Roy Scranton in seinem Essay »Raising my child in a doomed world« in der New York Times behaupten, wir konnten so wenig selbst entscheiden, wie wir lebten, wie wir die Naturgesetze hätten brechen können. Uns sie zu retten, lag nicht in unserer Hand. Aber das wäre gelogen. Der Klimawandel ist die größte Krise, der die Menschheit jemals gegenüberstand. Eine Krise, die wir nur gemeinsam angehen können und die jeden von uns ganz allein betrifft. Wir können nicht unsere vertrauten Mahlzeiten und zugleich unseren vertrauten Planeten behalten. Eins davon müssen wir aufgeben. So einfach und so schwierig sieht es nun mal aus. Wo waren Sie, als Sie sich entschieden haben?
At the Kaufleuten. Okay. Let's talk some practical things then. You have two sons, and I must say I can't really imagine raising a kid without the help of Wiener sausages and the like. How did you do that?
I can't imagine raising a child without the help of an iPad.
Okay.
A Wiener sausage, I can easily imagine the absence.
But there have been kids raised without iPads, so yeah, okay.
First of all, kids tend to meet our expectations. Uh-huh. So, you know, if you feed them Indian food and Korean food and Chinese food and Middle Eastern food and Greek food from an early age, then that's what they eat and that's what they expect, and it's fine. It's easy to slip into like macaroni and cheese all the time, and then that's what they do. So I actually haven't had that problem. And fortunately, we live in a time when no exaggeration, half of their friends are vegetarians. It's not an exaggeration. My 11-year-old son, he's going to be 11 next week, he probably knows more vegetarian kids than meat eaters.
They talk about it, so it's...
It's a casual thing.
Okay.
It's not like a big identity at this point. So that's fine. And, you know, before the first... When I started to write Eating Animals, the first research that I did was not to a factory farm. Mm-hmm. It was to a nutritionist because I wanted to make sure that it was healthy, because if it wasn't healthy, I just wouldn't do it, whatever the effects on the world are and whatever the effects on animals are. And we know that certainly it is every bit as healthy not to eat meat at all. And every pediatric nutritionist that I've spoken to has said that, and by the way, that's true for every stage of life, whether you are a toddler or a senior citizen, and it's true for any kind of life, whether you're a competitive athlete or the opposite.
What are you?
Vegetarians have a longer life expectancy. They suffer less from the biggest killers in the world, heart disease and cancer. Somebody who eats a diet that is heavy in animal protein is four times as likely to get cancer as somebody who eats a plant-based diet. To put that statistic in perspective, a smoker is three times as likely to get cancer as a non-smoker. So you affect your odds of having cancer more with your diet than you do with smoking. So I feel very good about that choice. People will say to me, how can you force your children to eat that way? Well, being a parent is to force your child to do things. You know, if we weren't vegetarians, I would be forcing
them. Why else would we have them?
I would be forcing them to eat meat if we didn't raise them as a vegetarian. I force them not to, you know, lick electrical sockets. I force them to go to school. But the way I think about it is actually not forcing a decision or an outcome. It's like creating a culture inside of my house. And for now, that culture does require me to make all kinds of decisions, but that's not the purpose. The real purpose is to try to raise them to be aware of what decisions are available, to be aware, first of all, when they're even making a decision, because we live in a world in which most of the decisions that we make are invisible to us. To be aware of the decisions that, when they're making a decision, what decisions are available, what the ramifications of those decisions are, how to be a citizen in the world, pursuing your own sense of what's right. It took me a long time to even begin to get on that journey myself, and I feel like I have so much distance to go that one of the gratifications of being a parent is the hope that they will do a better job, you know, than I was able to.
Was your mother upset when you started to be a vegetarian at 9 years? I mean, it's the one generation we have set now, but there's also this other generation that they cook, like your grandmother would make a beef brisket for Passover.
Of course,
she would not appreciate you if you wouldn't eat it.
I was very lucky in that they were extremely encouraging of it. I think kids who take any kind of ethical stand, any kind, it could be the opposite of what I would think is the right thing, deserve praise and are great. They're special. You know, like if my kids, they're into all kinds of things that I'm not into, and I find that really exciting because the most, the kinds of humans, people that I value most are the ones who have beliefs and act on them. I was lucky because my family has a lot of traditions and a lot of rituals, and meat is actually involved in an awful lot of those rituals. Religious rituals, American rituals. My dad would grill hamburgers on the 4th of July. We would have a turkey every Thanksgiving. At Passover, we would have brisket. My grandmother would make chicken every single time we went there. And so when I decided that I was not going to eat it, it was a big deal. It was a big change. They couldn't have been more supportive. You know, my grandmother continued to make matzo ball soup. She just figured out a way to make it. Or she told me she figured out a way to make that. I wouldn't be at all surprised if I was just eating the exact same thing. But you know what was really beautiful behind it was the lesson that they taught me, which was these are like artifacts of our values, but they are not our values. They're just food. Our values are something else. Like when we gather at the Thanksgiving table, we're not celebrating turkey. We're using turkey as a vehicle for celebrating gratitude and celebrating bounty and celebrating all that we have. And it's to question whether it's a good symbol, and it's really the worst symbol. You know, every turkey that's eaten in the United States was produced by artificial insemination. Every single turkey. Turkeys are not capable of reproducing sexually anymore because they've been bred to grow so big that they can't have intercourse. Is that a good symbol of gratitude? Is that a good symbol of bounty? Of
family tradition.
Yeah. So what I have found in my experience when I was a kid and through adulthood is that sometimes questioning traditions does not undermine traditions. It actually reaffirms traditions. It's a way to say, this is the thing that we believed in this whole time. This is what we've been talking about this whole time. And we don't need that. We don't need that particular thing. Any given meal is interchangeable. It is. But gratitude is not an interchangeable theme. And celebrating harvest is not an interchangeable theme. An awareness of the changing of the seasons and what happens when the seasons change is a fundamental thing. So I find that those rituals are actually much richer now than they were before.
That's really interesting because I was going to ask you how you think that society will change once we get sort of rid of this the social practice of eating meat together. But now, if I understand you correctly, you think it won't change at all. We just don't eat meat to it. It doesn't make any difference.
That is what I believe it is. And that sort of points to something else, which is we can look at these things as diminishments, like, ooh, we're going to have less in the future. And I don't think that that's how it will feel. I think it will feel that we have more. If you think about like the happiness that's involved when you eat a meal, it ends with the last bite. You don't take pleasure in a meal after you've eaten it. If anything, it starts to feel not as good. But to get more pleasure from food, you have to eat more food. But the pleasure of like closing the distance between the person that you want to be and the person you actually are, it's not as immediate as the pleasure of food. Of course it's not. And it's not as primitive. But I think it's a much richer kind of happiness. If you just were to imagine that Zurich decided, let's be the first carbon neutral city in the world, you know, it would involve an awful lot of change. And it would involve a lot of things that felt like sacrifice or maybe diminishment or at least like effort. When the rest of the world looked at Zurich and said, how did they do that? That's incredible. When people wanted to follow the model of Zurich, when mayors of other cities came to Zurich to learn about how you did it, like, would that feel bad or would that feel good? Do you think that the average level of happiness in Zurich would be lower than it is today or greater than it is today? Obviously, we would take enormous gratification from it. Which is the opposite of the alienation that so many of us feel or the low-level sadness that so many of us feel now. I have a friend whose mother got a terrible cancer diagnosis, and he was in the room with her when she got it. And it was almost like out of a movie. The doctor came in and said, I've got some very bad news. The scan came back, and you have a month to live. And she said what I would have said and what probably most people would say or at least think, which is, why me? She said, why me? And then she said the opposite of what I would have said, which is, why have I been so lucky? You know, why have I had so many good things happen to me? And we can look at the situation we have now as, oh God, I have to fly less. I have to eat less of this stuff that I like. Now they're telling me I have to worry about what kind of clothes I buy. Now they're telling me I can't use straws. Now they're telling me this. We can look at all of that as diminishments, or we could say we get an awful lot in return for those things. You know, we're just too used to them. It's like the water that we swim in. But if we weren't used to it, and if like an alien came down and said, I have a deal to offer you. You can be outside for 365 days a year. You can have a life expectancy into the 80s. You can have 4 seasons. You can have cities that are on the water. You can have leaves that are on trees. You can have a diversity of species. You can have different kinds of landscapes. You can have polar ice sheets, and so on and so on and so on and so on, all of the things, mm-hmm. hundreds of thousands of things that we have. And in exchange, I need you to do a couple things for me. You have to fly less, you have to drive less, you have to eat less meat and eat less dairy.
90%.
90%. And you have to control your population. We would say, oh my God, that's the best deal that anybody's ever been offered.
You're starting a revolution.
We would we would jump at that deal. We just don't recognize that that's the deal we're being offered right now because we already have the things that we love and we're just too used to them. So if we can somehow find a way to remember all that we have, then this is going to seem much, much easier. And it's not going to seem like a sacrifice or diminishment. It's going to seem like lucky us.
Well, thank you so much, Jonathan, for all this inspiration. And Zurich is going to be the next carbon-free city, I assume, because people are now... Well, thank you, Kaufleuten, for this great venue. Thank you, Ariela Saalbacher, for reading, for your nice interpretation. Thank you, Daniel Nufer, who will host the bookstore from the bookstore Pile of Books, so that everybody can buy a copy of We Are the Weather. I think it's in German and English, I hope. For sure, we have the Kiwi edition in German. You can write your life plans in them, and Jonathan will witness them and sign them outside in the foyer. Thank you so much for being with us, talking to us, and thank you all for listening. And I'm very excited about what's going to happen.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Das war der amerikanische Schriftsteller Jonathan Safran Foer im Gespräch mit der Zeit Online-Redakteurin Judith Luig am 23. Januar 2020 im Kaufleuten in Zürich. Weitere Gespräche wie die Zeit-Matineen mit dem Zeit-Herausgeber Josef Joffe und mir sowie andere Interviews von Zeitredakteuren und Redakteurinnen mit Gästen finden Sie unter zeit.de/zeitbühne. Mein Name ist Roman Blätter, ich bin stellvertretender Wirtschaftsressortleiter der Zeit und ich freue mich auf das nächste Mal mit Ihnen und Zeitbühne. Danke fürs Zuhören und bleiben Sie uns gewogen.